The news from Wall Street this week would have been perhaps even uglier yesterday if it weren't for some good economic news from the U.S. Labor Department. The U.S. economy in April gained 290,000 jobs. That's the biggest increase in 4 years, and it suggests the economic recovery is gaining some momentum. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
We've heard a lot about the decline of manufacturing in the U.S., but the economy has actually been adding tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs over the past few months.
We have hired back about 20 people in the last 6 months. That's about 20% of our workforce.
Fred Pierce is the president of Metalworks in Londonderry, New Hampshire. The company builds metal boxes for medical equipment and other electronics gear. Pierce is standing in front of a big red machine that's robotically whipping back and forth big pieces of sheet metal. It looks sort of like a giant 10-foot-tall red stapler.
This is what's known as a turret punch press.
So each one of those bangs is a hole being punched through a sheet of metal?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Last year, a lot of this expensive equipment here was just sitting idle, and there was no business coming in. Pierce had to lay off almost half of his workforce.
There were moments where we were just saying, what are we going to do? How are we going to keep this place going? We didn't want to lay any more people off. It's such a hard thing to do, and it's so great to be able to bring people back.
This latest jobs report from the Labor Department shows that in lots of other industries, too, companies that had been laying people off are starting to hire again.
This is basically very, very good news.
Nariman Baravesh is chief economist at the forecasting firm IHS Global Insight.
This is a much bigger number than most analysts were thinking, and it's broad-based. Not only the service sectors, which we knew would do fairly well, but manufacturing and construction, interestingly enough, all generated new jobs. And even better is that the prior 2 months were revised up.
Baravesh says the report is further evidence that the economic recovery has legs. Still, those legs have a long journey ahead of them, and they've only taken just the first few steps.
One way to look at this past recession is that in terms of jobs loss, about 8 million, it's actually worse than the last four recessions put together. So this is a very deep hole we're in terms of employment. It's going to take us quite a while to climb out of it.
Baravesh thinks it will take about 5 years for unemployment to get back down to around 6%. In fact, while the economy gained jobs in April, the unemployment rate actually went up a bit to 9.9%. That's because people who had given up hope of finding a job actually started looking again. That pushes the unemployment rate higher when those people try to re-enter the workforce. And there are still millions more people like that who haven't yet been factored into the unemployment rate.
So this is a CNC laser cutting machine, and it actually uses a laser light beam to cut through steel.
Back at the Metalworks factory, you can get a sense of the long and tenuous road ahead from Fred Pierce.
I can't even say I'm optimistic. I'm just cautious. I'm looking forward to being cautiously optimistic.
So you're not even cautiously optimistic yet?
That is correct.
Part of Pierce's worry is that while business has picked up a bit, he says he still senses a lot of uncertainty out there in the economy. And he just doesn't know whether he can count on that business being there a month or two from now.
I have no idea. I mean, we're on pins and needles here every day trying to figure out how we're going to manage this business.
Economists, too, say the world is still recovering from a crisis in the banking system and a big recession at the same time, and that just makes it hard to predict what's coming next. But they say a good jobs report is definitely a step in the right direction. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Frederick Ryken's new novel might make you believe there's no such thing as a stranger. It opens in Florida in 1984, where Beverly Rabinowitz, a doctor born in Poland who escaped the Holocaust, vacations with her boyfriend David, who has cancer, and his son, Jordan, who knows it. They swim with manatees who seem gentle and knowing. But each step of the story gets a new narrator. Jordan takes over, then Tim, a tour guide and musician, then Dee, a singer, and then Jennifer, Beverly's daughter, as the action moves between Utah, New Jersey, and Israel and snaps up an uncommon assortment of characters, including an FBI agent named Leopold, an Israeli soldier named Amon, who remind us how seemingly unrelated lives can all come together in the net of a master storyteller. Frederick Ryken, whose previous books include the highly acclaimed Lost Legends of New Jersey, is director of the graduate program in writing at Emerson College, joins us from WBUR in Boston. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be here.
So how do you explain this story? The early reviews from, like, Publishers Weekly have been just absolutely laudatory. But everybody's kind of stuck to explain the narrative.
What I would say is that I structured this book around dual protagonists, the one being Beverly Rabinowitz, who is... Her story is essentially the mystery of the fate of her father, Jonah Rabinowitz, and what may or may not have happened to him during the Holocaust. The surprise character that came into this book that I wasn't really planning on was this Catherine Clay Goldman, who is almost an alter ego or double or maybe even doppelganger for Beverly. And she's this elusive 60s era radical. And what
guerrilla puppeteer.
Yeah, and guerrilla puppeteer among her many various identities and names. I found that if I managed to touch on one or the other of these two mysteries, the mystery of Beverly's father, or essentially the mystery of Catherine Clay Goldman and who she might or might not be, it maintained the traction of the novel through the disparate narratives. So I guess you could ultimately say it's a book about connection and the way people are interconnected, whether they know it or not.
In the center of the book, there's just the nicest little love story. In this unforgettable section set along the Dead Sea, your narrator at that point, who's a veterinarian from Western Massachusetts, goes to live in a kibbutz for her health.
Yes.
And she meets a blonde goy from Utah who whisks her away on his motorcycle.
Right. That's the chapter that everything kind of turns on, because you've heard about the blonde goy in an earlier chapter.
He's in a coma there.
You meet him when he's crashed his motorcycle, and you meet him, and then you... almost in a Rashomon-like way, go through the accident from the point of view of the veterinarian, Vicky, and you also then get the aftermath of that and how that story comes full circle and plays out both in terms of Vicky's larger story and also how it connects back up with Beverly and with Catherine Clay Goldman.
I wrote something down that just as when I finished the book, this just had me thinking ever since. One of your narrators writes, you write, "I recognize that we are all magicians in some way. We are complicit in all we see and comprehend that what we will see will never coincide with absolute reality. As a result, the human brain must make a narrative."
Yeah, well, no one reality is privileged. It can always shift when a larger or differing perspective is introduced. At the level of just the idea that we are all magicians in some way, we are. We use a metaphorical version of sleight of hand all the time in our lives. There's so much indirection in our lives. We will be thinking about something one way, some other current will hit us. Every now and then you have one of these epiphanic moments where you actually do feel like everything is strangely aligned, and you don't quite know why, but it's there. And it's there, I think, in the way that we do make narratives. That's how we go about interpreting the world. I think while we process this way and make narratives to understand our lives, it's important not to get stuck in any one narrative. I think most of the biggest problems in the world come from people being stuck in a particular narrative and being unwilling to see another point of view or acknowledge another belief system.
Frederick Ryken, speaking from Boston, his new novel, Day for Night. I don't know if a technical malfunction helped set off the historic 1,000-point nosedive that the Dow Jones Industrial Average took for 15 minutes on Thursday afternoon. The market rebounded to lose only 348 points by the closing bell. The Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating what caused so quick a crash in recovery. Traders have a phrase for transactions in which somebody, as reportedly may have happened this week, hit so many zeros by mistake that millions become billions. A fat-fingered trade. Well, The B is just a couple of keys over from the M. Now, before you say that people who earn so many zillions, oh, sorry, wrong key, I meant millions, should keep their fingers felt and on target, ask yourself if you've recently sent an important or embarrassing email to the wrong person. Computer systems react more quickly than humans. Our brains are easily distracted. We have changing moods and fat fingers. Engineers consider systems that think and react more quickly than we do and focus completely as progress, not a problem to be solved. It's fair to point out that if the Dow had lost more than 10% of its value on Thursday, other systems designed to halt trading were programmed to snap into place. A generation ago, there was a fear that a nuclear war could be set off by accident, not just by some rogue general as in Dr. Strangelove, but by a technical malfunction occurring in clever and intricate machines. In Failsafe, the best-selling novel of the 1960s, a small puff of smoke sprouts and disappears in the back of a machine. A chain reaction of events is set off, and Moscow and New York City disappear in nuclear fireballs. A computer magnate who built many of those systems tells a general helplessly, when you pile intricate systems on top of each other, something's bound to break. When they do, other machines react too quickly for us to catch them. The American president, played, of course, by Henry Fonda in the movie, tells the Soviet premier after he reaches a fateful decision, we place too much faith in our machines. People in software and computers like to remind us that behind every technical malfunction, there's usually a human error. The fat finger that gets stuck on zero, or the space engineers who confused English and metric units and crashed the 1999 Mars Polar Orbiter into the planet. Most of us have done something more modestly mindless in just the last week. The momentary loss of so many billions of dollars, which are not just a bunch of zeros after all, but people's life savings, college funds, and homes, might be a sobering reminder of how fragile and fleeting security can be. It can be wiped out, not just by catastrophe, conflict, or upheaval, but a few fat fingers.
I'm the operator with my pocket calculator. I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Kraftwerk, seriously, and this is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
Julie Andrews is no nun. She's a funny, tough showbiz survivor who got her start as little girl who sang in the London subways during the Blitz and climbed on top of beer crates to sing with her mother and stepfather in smoky music halls. Of course, she would go on to play Maria in The Sound of Music, Queen Guinevere in Camelot, Mary Poppins, and Eliza Doolittle on stage in My Fair Lady, a nun, a nanny, a queen, and the flower girl who becomes the vision of a princess. But doctors found a non-cancerous nodule in her throat in 1997. The operation to remove it left Julie Andrews unable to sing. She sued her surgeons. They settled out of court. She went on to play speaking roles and write children's books. She became Dame Julie in 1999. I was raised never to carp about things and never to moan, she told an interviewer, because in vaudeville you just got on with it through all kinds of adversities. Tonight, Dame Julie Andrews will return to the London stage for the first time in 30 years. She'll sing with the London Philharmonic in a show she's put together called The Gift of Music, featuring the music of Rodgers and Hammerstein, and Dame Julie reading some of her own stories. I don't sing the way I used to, she cautioned, so I'm doing everything I can to put the word out that the audience shouldn't expect that. But 12 years after she was told she'll never sing again, I'll bet the audience will hear any song by Julie Andrews as an unexpected gift.
I could have danced all night, I could have danced all night, and still have begged for more. I could have spread my wings and done a thousand things I've never done before. I'll never know what made it so.
Time now for a look back at the week in the news. We're joined by NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
And let's take the apparently the botched bombing, car bombing in Times Square first. Here we have a Pakistani-born U.S. citizen who was accused of trying to set off a car bomb using an SUV in one of the busiest thoroughfares in the world, mm-hmm. Times Square. As you look at what we know, what strikes you?
Well, what strikes me is the sheer incompetence that went along with this effort, and it has happened several times before. You get a handful of people go to Pakistan and walk into a trap, and they're arrested. You get the shoe bomber, and the shoes don't work. You get
this was Richard Reed,
and you find on several occasions these people, they go to Pakistan to get training to be terrorists. And then in several cases, thank God, it doesn't work. The other thing that strikes me is the way in which this guy, when he's finally found on the airplane and is supposed to have said, I was expecting you, and then goes and talks without worrying about Miranda rights, talks at great length, apparently, and then part, apparently, of the thrill of the terrorist act is being caught and talking about it.
Was the United States of America just lucky to have averted a terrorist act? Is there an agency that deserves some credit?
I don't know about agencies that deserve credit. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, certainly claims a lot of credit. He called a press conference at 1:30 in the morning to make the announcement. So he apparently thinks that the Justice Department deserves credit, although some people think more credit should have gone to people in New York.
Well, but I mean, to refresh our recollection, this was an accused bomber who was arrested on an airplane that was within minutes of taking off because the federal watch list hadn't been refreshed.
That's right. Well, there were things that were mistakes, and there was an element of luck in this. There had to be an element of luck. If the guy has bought the wrong kind of fertilizer and it smokes and doesn't go off, that certainly is lucky for our side. And it's terrible to have to depend on that. But apparently we're getting a generation of these young people who go and say, jihad is what we're here for. We want to try to kill. And if we're very good at it, there'll be others.
Mm. Gulf Coast states, as well as the federal government environmental groups, are continuing to try and avert further disaster from the British Petroleum oil spill in the Gulf. And BP itself has come up with some elaborate plans to try and stem the flow of oil. Where does that situation sit this week?
Well, the situation is in a very tenuous state. They are working very hard to try to cap this oil flow. They're waiting for when it first happens that a large amount of oil washes up against shores. It's taken longer than they expected, but it apparently is still there as a great menace to the marshes and to all. And we sit and wait with bated breath to see what happens.
What do you make of the week in Wall Street, particularly on Thursday? Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped almost 1,000 points in about 30 minutes before rebounding.
Yes. Well, part of that is supposed to possibly that there was an error made on the computer. I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. But something is going on that starts somewhere in Athens, where you have this country which is almost going down the drain, speaking figuratively, of course. And then you wonder, how long can this go on? And then you say they're in the Eurozone, so the Eurozone will be affected, other countries will be affected, and at some point, it comes washing up against our shores. And I think that is the reason why Wall Street can react to chaos in Athens.
Mm-hmm. Well, because under the world financial system, it's not possible for any industrial nation to be free of that, is it?
That's right. And the word bailout has now been exported.
I want to ask you about the British elections and the onset of a new government there, because the three parties are still wrangling over how to form a new government or not. There's always talk about the special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom, sharing, as we do, not just a common language, and I know we're sometimes divided by a common language, but many similar notions about democracy, and for that matter, in recent years, diversity. Do you see that special relationship being affected by this outcome?
Well, I don't know about the outcome. The special relationship hasn't been very special ever since the invasion of Iraq. Most of the British really think that they were dragged into a war by the United States and didn't like it. And that relationship has not recovered since that time. But under present conditions, I think whoever is the new prime minister, I don't think it will change very much. It's a cool relationship now and probably will remain so.
Regardless of who takes power, what did you read in the results of the election?
That the British, a lot like Americans, can sometimes not quite make up their minds. They did the thing which makes it most difficult to form. They didn't provide a majority. But as we survive our form of election, they will survive theirs.
NPR Senior News Analyst Dan Shore, thanks very much.
Sure.